please join me in welcoming our Attorney General, Steve Marshall.
Good morning, everybody. I will tell you, this has already been an expensive trip for me. Many of you, have you heard of challenge coins? Everybody know what challenge coins are? My biggest and heaviest is from Donald Trump. I'd love to show you what they are. Anyway, the tradition of a challenge coin is that, and it was told this by a two-star general, that when you give somebody your challenge coin, you honor them, and when you see them again, if they have it on them, then you're required to be able to, in the military tradition, pay for their drinks. But as I tell young people, that I'll buy their lunch. And so Judge Motley is one of my appointees to a committee. Wes, thank you for being able to do that. Wes was in my office the other day and got a new challenge coin, and I was like, will you give this to your son, please? And he is with us today. And so when I went over to say good morning to him, I said, did you get the coin from me, Daddy? And he said, yeah. I said, remember that tradition? And he said, if you don't have it, you got to buy my lunch, and if you got it, I got to buy yours. And y'all, he had it in his pocket, and I just gave him $10. So, I would say I have lived up to my end of the bargain, and if he wants to show that to you later, he can. Gosh, that's so cool. So, y'all, it's good to be back. Good to be with lots of old friends that are here today. And I really think about what can we do to make this time beneficial. You know, I'm already enriched anytime I get a Jonathan Bell prayer. It is a good day, Judge. Thank you for sharing those talents. You've got a direct line to the Lord. But here's kind of my mission, and I'll use a Ronald Reagan story to be able to tell you what I think we want to be able to do today. And Ronald Reagan was giving a speech one time, and he was talking about a location in D.C., and he said that at one point they held a Democratic rally, and when the Democrats were leaving, there was a boy outside, and he was yelling, Democratic puppies for sale, Democratic puppies for sale. And about 2 weeks later, they were holding a Republican rally at the same location, and that same boy was outside, but this time he was saying, Republican puppies for sale, Republican puppies for sale. And there was a reporter that had been there 2 weeks earlier, and was there that night, and walked up to him and said, hey, 2 weeks ago you were selling those as Democratic puppies, today you sell them as Republicans. What's the difference? And he said, now they got their eyes open. So maybe this morning, my effort is really to kind of give you a little sense of kind of the stuff that we've been working on. Because, you know, one time, when you're in the role like I have, you don't always get the feedback to know, are you doing the right things and are you engaged in the right issues? And the recent feedback I've gotten maybe shows me that we're where we need to be, because I had Gavin Newsom tweeting at me, Hillary Clinton tweeting at me, I had the Washington Post tweeting at me, all doing this in 1 week. And then recently we had a runoff election in Birmingham with two Democratic candidates, and one of the transgender candidates said she was going down to fight extremism in Montgomery, and she used my face on the commercial. So y'all, I think if I've got the governor of California and Hillary Clinton coming at me and the transgender movement saying that I am the extreme views in our state, I'm probably in a good place. And so let me just sort of talk to you a little bit about some of the things we're working on, and I'm really probably going to hit a variety of topics, and then y'all be around afterwards if you got some questions. But the one thing I want to start with, maybe a little bit different, is I want to share with you a little bit of the personal nature of what I see going on right now in the news, not only in Israel, but what I see going on in our country. Because uniquely, y'all, it's been just a little over 2 months that I was standing on a hill looking at Gaza. I was less than a mile away. I was with several law enforcement folks. We were over there working with their intelligence officials and law enforcement officials talking about anti-Semitism. And y'all, I understood it a little bit, but when that fateful Saturday just a few weeks ago came about and we saw the invasion, what was on my TV screen was the very city, Sderot, that I was standing looking at Gaza, that I had met with their law enforcement officials, that I had been with their mayor and his command post where he was talking about what happens when rocket fire comes over. And the video I was seeing were dead mothers and children on the side of a road, people killed at bus stops, law enforcement had been in a firefight. with those terrorists in a police station that I had stood in just 2 months earlier, caved to the ground. And y'all, it was very personal to me. This was the third time I've had the privilege of being able to go to Israel, a couple of really amazing Bible study trips. I will tell you that every time I'm there, I feel like I'm home, that there's a kinship with the people and what that nation stands for. Being physically there shows you how they have enemies all around them, and you understand exactly their desire, not only to live peacefully, but to also live in that territory as God's chosen people. And so it's something that has struck me. But the other thing that I think has emerged from this is, to the extent that people criticize us for talking about woke philosophy in our academic institutions and our higher education institutions, we are seeing that now. I hope y'all are watching some of the protests going on around our country, where you have young people supporting terrorists who beheaded children, and somehow or another justifying that as correct, criticizing the right to Israel to even be in that territory, and somehow or another wanting to glorify those who want to destroy not only the nation of Israel, but its people. And you hear individuals that want to say that the Holocaust never happened, or that somehow or another it's a figment of our imagination. And y'all, I was on that trip in the Holocaust Museum. I had the privilege of being able to lay a wreath in your honor at that memorial, seeing again those pictures and what took place against the Jewish people. And I think it's a reminder again why the fight that we fight is so critical. Because while the left wants to push it to the side, we are seeing that manifest now with our young people. And as we look at our nation's greatest ally in Israel and their right to defend themselves against this continued terror, we're going to have to stand strong, because it's already we're seeing people back away from that. Not only those that are very critical of Israel as a nation, but those in those protests that somehow or another want to stop Israel from saying they have a right to defend what happened. See some of the videos and the pictures, if you hadn't, some that's now being released of what actually took place that day, and the true joy that the terrorists took in taking the lives of women and children, many in their sleep, is that this is should be for all of us something that is incredibly personal, and that we need to stand strongly with them. We see some Democrats doing that, but y'all can tell you they're going to fall off. And it's up to us to be able to stand strong. I don't have much of an affinity for what's going on in Ukraine, but I do in Israel. And we as a nation need to be able to stand strong with them. And I realize that's a little bit different thing to talk about as AG, but yet I think it's something that is, as people of faith, it's important to us, but also as conservative leaders in our country, we need to be able to stand strong with them. So, all right, let me dive into some of the stuff at home. And I really want to brag on my legislative friends that are here. Andrew and Jenny, I know that I've seen Senator Livingston is here as well. This was the best session that we've had relating to criminal justice issues in my now 7 years as AG. And I think y'all know a little bit about my background. I come from the world of being a district attorney. Summer's much better at that than me already. She's going to continue to be amazing in that role, but I just am somebody that has just been blessed to be able to work with people like Sheriff Shavers my whole life, and that's been a remarkable blessing for me. And it's why uniquely the ability to be their voice and to be able to share their stories is important. And two things that have come about recently that they were very responsive to is now I think going to make a difference in our state, and one of which really emerged out of tragedy. We lost a deputy sheriff by the name of Brad Johnson in Bibb County. Brad Johnson was following a guy who had done a string of burglaries just in a neighboring county in Shelby County, and he was shot and killed by the person that he was chasing. The backstory on his murderer was that he had not so long ago had been released from prison after serving a sentence there in which he escaped. He left a work police facility, had to be found in Georgia, actually fought law enforcement when he was eventually captured. But y'all, we have this thing in Alabama, and the judges know about this, and the prosecutors know about it, but it's called good time credit, correctional incentive time. It means that if we put you in jail, we're going to take some time off your sentence if you're doing the things you're supposed to do. But yet, this guy who escaped from our prison system was still given correctional incentive time, good time, while he was out early. And y'all, that was wrong. If we're going to one to incentivize good behavior in prison. How in the world can walking away, committing another offense, somehow or another allow you to be rewarded? But it was, and we lost Brad Johnson as a result of that. And so we went to the legislature and said, this is insane. And y'all, I got criticized as being overly harsh. Let me tell you what we proposed the legislation they adopted. We said, all right, if you want to give good time credit, then let's don't award it if somebody assaults a guard while they're in prison. Let's don't award it if they assault another inmate while they're in prison. And clearly, let's don't do it if they escape from prison while they're serving their sentence. And y'all, ain't that just crazy? No, it's common sense. And the legislature adopted that, and y'all, I think we have substantial changes that are positive. Because what I want when Judge Bell or Judge Taylor is sentencing somebody to a prison sentence, Andrew, you as well, I don't mean to exclude you, but they need to know how long somebody's going to serve. They don't need to speculate on what that means. And y'all, when Summer gives somebody a 15-year sentence, and that really means it's 3 years and 7 months, that didn't cut it, I don't think. And now with this change, we're going to have more significant sentences for the people that need to be there, and they're clearly not going to be rewarded for bad behavior which took place there. And so to my legislative friends, thank you for that. And the other thing that they did, and y'all say, just truthfully, it's probably not as much of an issue it is for Cherokee County as others, but it can still can be here. And that is the significant rise of violence that we've seen in our state that's attributable to gang violence. We had no law in our state that allowed law enforcement to deal with gangs. And I'm not necessarily talking about MS-13 or the Bloods or the Crips, although y'all, the cartel has a presence in our state, and it's one of the reasons why securing the border is so important. But we said if three or more people come together to do bad things, to commit crimes, should we have a law in the books that says we can deal with that a little bit differently? Because the one thing that I do know is that gang crime elevates itself quickly. When I hear the story, for example, in Birmingham of a gang member that's brought to the hospital after being shot, and they're literally in the bay of the ER at UAB, and they're getting shot by another gang member who shot somebody else, I think that's a problem. And yet, we had no tool in the toolbox to be able to kind of go after it. And so, legislature passed a bill, which uniquely we called a gang prevention bill, but the Democrats said, we'll vote for it if you call it the criminal enterprise bill. I didn't care what we called it as long as we had something to deal with it. All but four members of the House and the Senate voted for it. I think unanimously in the Senate, only four members in the House didn't vote for it. And what it did was define a gang. And one of the things I think is fun about it is we have 10 factors to be able to prove it, including whether your mom or your daddy says you're a member. And, you know, lots of mom and dads want to tell us that, so we're going to have that as a good tool. But it says if you're in a gang and you commit a crime, we're going to elevate your punishment. If it's a C, it becomes a B. If it becomes a Class B, it becomes a Class A. If it's Class A, we're going to even elevate it more. So we have the ability to have a greater sentence. And then also to be able to say if you're a gang member, commit a gang crime with a gun, then we're going to make you serve certain mandatory minimums. And y'all, that is, you don't get good time credits, you don't get any time off, that is a day-for-day time that you're going to serve. So that if you just have a gun committing that offense, we're going to make you serve at least 5 years. If you brandish a gun, it's going to be more than that. And if you use the gun in the commission of that gang violence, we're going to make sure that you serve significant time. And y'all, that, I think, is a huge, huge change for us in our state. I can tell you that I've had, even in blue cities, the mayors that aren't normally with law enforcement saying this is something that they want. And now as a result of the work of the legislature, we have that. We're now out training all over the state to make sure law enforcement understands how to prove it. We are working in our office to create a unique unit. And actually, Thomas Govan will help lead that charge with his group to be able to prosecute these cases around the state. And we want to send a very strong message. Number one, if you're going to be a part of a gang, there are consequences to that. But also, we're going to say that if you commit those offenses at a younger age, which we're seeing across our state, we're going to treat you as an adult. Because if you're 16 and above, we're going to say you don't get the protections of juvenile court. We're not going to make you eligible for youthful offender. But instead, you commit a crime like you're an old person, we're going to treat you like that older person for purposes of that offense. So, y'all, very pleased with what the legislature gave us because we told them what we needed and they responded. And I think it, again, has probably been the best session that we've had on that front, because I heard the demand from my friends in law enforcement that this was something that, they needed to be able to do their jobs better. Now the legislature's given us that tool, and I think we'll see some changes on that. And to the extent we get gang members in Cherokee County, by golly, we're going to be able to do it. Summer's going to be able to do it. But I think it's going to help us in many of our cities that are around the state and going there. All right, shift gears to you a little bit on some of the litigation that we're doing, because you know, one of the things that, I'm proud of is, the ability to serve right now as chair of the Republican Attorney General Association. And so what that does is gives me the ability to help direct the fight that we have against the Biden administration. Many of y'all may remember the name Greg Abbott. Greg Abbott is the governor of Texas. He used to be the attorney general there during the President Obama's years. And one day he was giving a speech probably somewhat similar to this, and they asked him, what's a typical day like for the attorney general? And he said, I come to work, I sue the federal government, I go home. Now, we have a little of that at our place, because they give us so much room to be able to do it. In fact, I think right now that in just my time during the Biden administration, we've had almost 260 cases filed against them. We have these things called comment letters that we use to be able to highlight certain things. So very active. But the good thing that we're able to do is to kind of collectively get the expertise of offices around the state, and then we're able to use those as a force multiplier. So West Virginia, very active on energy and coal issues. Louisiana does a lot of oil and gas stuff. And I can tell you where I've leveraged Alabama is around the idea of religious liberty and making sure that we defend those issues that directly impact our ability to freely exercise our faith. And not only to be able to freely exercise our faith, but also to attack those things that go directly against kind of the values that, we share. And I can tell you that legislature gave me an opportunity to place Alabama in a unique position, and that's protecting our kids. Because we passed a law a couple of years ago that says this gender-affirming of care for somebody that's 12-year-old that says suddenly that I think I'm a boy rather than a girl is not something that we need to use drugs to treat. That I get gender dysphoria is something that's real, but there are ways of dealing with that absent giving puberty blockers or other drugs that are off-label or committing surgeries against kids that, in my mind, are child abuse, that we say that that's wrong. You know, I catch a lot of heat for that, and that's okay. That's part of what you, sign me up for. But we've said that Alabama's going to stand for kids. We're going to expose the lie that relates to this gender-affirming care. And, y'all, sadly, I didn't know we had this in the sense of much expertise in Alabama, but yet we had a clinic at UAB that was one of those that was espousing this philosophy. In fact, the physician there, who was transgender themselves, was talking about one of their patients one time and glorified suicide. And it was almost offensive to be able to listen to. And so what I have tasked our team with is not only as we defend that law, because we were challenged not only by a group of, plaintiffs led by the ACLU and the SPLC and those type of groups, but also the Department of Justice. Because don't think for a second that there's not radical gender ideology coming from the Biden administration. They want locker rooms that, you can pick and choose where you go to, bathrooms you can pick and choose, and they want to use school lunch money as a way of holding kids hostage to make Alabama do something inconsistent with their values relating to bathrooms themselves. But they've sued us on this case, and, we pushed back, and frankly, we pushed back hard. And uniquely, we hadn't been winning these. We lost in front of Judge Burke, who is a dear friend of mine initially. He enjoined Alabama's case. We saw similar laws in Arkansas and Kentucky and Tennessee and Florida and Georgia where judges said, no, I don't know that you have a right to do it. And then we began to really expose the lie. And the fact that this gender-affirming care is now rejected in Europe where it kind of started as a failed experiment. You know, I can't tell you how many young people, I'm talking 22, 23-year-old girls I've sat in front of who told me about taking a needle once a week with testosterone and putting it into their thigh and then describing now, I was just confused. You know, social media is driving a lot of this, and there's a longer story for another day. Peer pressure is really strong in this area.
But I heard those kids talk about what a mistake that was and how it has impacted their lives in an adverse way for a long time. I had an individual from New York who called me and said, look, this has destroyed my life. Y'all have to do something about it. And so we've now been able to dive in, and we've talked about it, and we've shown how Europe is demonstrating these are not appropriate standards of care, that is profit-driven. And yet, somehow or another, we have liberal groups that are coordinating with the federal government to be able to drive that in our country. But now we're beginning to win. We won a case out of Ohio, then we won a case in Kentucky, we won a case in Tennessee, then we won the case over in Georgia, and then we won our case in the 11th Circuit. And I'm proud to tell you that Alabama drove not only the legal theory, but the facts in every one of those, because we were willing to invest the resources in our state to say that we're going to protect kids, not only in Alabama, but across the country. And sometimes people say, well, gosh, isn't that a waste of time? No. No. When we can help protect kids, then that's where Alabama needs to be positioned. And I'm proud of what we've done there. You know, we actually hired some outside lawyers. We had to go to contract review. And I don't mind telling y'all, we have a contract that goes up to $500,000 for group lawyers to be able to help us. And yeah, that's a lot of money, and I get it. But it was funny when I read somebody had a comment when this was some of my friends at AL.com who don't like me very much, posted a story about it. Somebody put underneath it, money well spent. And y'all, it is money well spent to develop a team to be able to do that. And again, I think that we're making a substantial difference. But that is a fight that is going on at a national level, all around sort of this radical gender philosophy. And it's a fight now that I think that we're beginning to win, and frankly, that we have to win. Because there are far too many young people right now that need us and want us to intervene, and we need to make sure that we have that opportunity. The second battle that is not as impactful up here specifically, but is in the state as a whole, is around the redistricting fight. And Steve Livingston, thank you again for your leadership. It would have been real easy to capitulate to the left to a federal judge and not continue to stand strong on the right principles of law, and you did, and thank you for that. But y'all, you hear these terms tossed around about Alabama being defiant to a federal judge or the federal judges. Y'all, we have a right to litigate. We have a right to advance a position that is correct. And y'all, I don't want to accept this idea that a federal judge says we need to racially discriminate to fix what they believe is racial discrimination. That didn't make sense at all. That's segregation. That's not developing equality in the law. But here's the reality. The Voting Rights Act says very specifically kind of what its requirements are. But it also says we don't require proportionality. That if you have a certain percentage of minority population, it doesn't require there be a certain similar percentage of elected representatives from that particular minority. But yet, that's exactly what the federal judge has done. They said we have roughly 26% black population in Alabama, and that means that we have 26% of our representatives in essence go from one to two that are representing the state. What these federal judges are basically trying to do is guarantee Democrat seats in our state, which is not what the Voting Rights Act requires. But yeah, that's exactly what they're attempting to do. Let me just sort of tell you how much of a lie the lawyers want to purport in that. And Steve, I don't know if you've even heard this as well. South Carolina is dealing with a similar case. And we have the same lawyers representing the Alabama folks that are representing the people over in South Carolina. One of the things they argued over there is that the state had divided up their port city and removed minority population to connect them with folks over 100 miles away. Because the idea when you're drawing these lines is you're supposed to be compact. You're supposed to kind of keep people together. You're supposed to keep what they call communities of interest, people that have kind of a unique affinity to one another, either by geography or culture or something very similar. And they argue basically that you were dividing a community of interest because you're taking people away from the coast and putting them with folks far inland. So they said that was wrong. They just argued that in front of the Supreme Court. But yet in Alabama, when our legislature kept our Gulf Coast together, they argued, no, we need to do something different. Let's, in fact, let's pull the Port of Mobile and the minority population away from the city of Mobile, and let's connect them all the way over to Phoenix City. So So y'all do your geography a little bit, right? To get to Phenix City from Mobile, you got to go all the way up to Montgomery, and then go all the way over to Phenix City. Y'all, the reality is the people in Phenix City don't know that there's a city called Biola Battery, right? I mean, there's no connection between people who border Georgia and people who border the Gulf Coast, but yet the same people that argued it was offensive to do it in South Carolina have said that's the remedy to create equal opportunity in Alabama. And y'all, you can't have it both ways. You can't. And I'm sorry, the fact that we're standing up to a federal court, I don't back away from that. Because I have a right to fight on behalf of what I think is right for our state. And I'm grateful for a legislature that still stood strong, that developed a map. That, number one, I don't think their first one was wrong. And this is one, we do have a conservative Supreme Court. But y'all, John Roberts isn't always with us. Brett Kavanaugh isn't always with us. And I firmly believe that they did some horse trading behind the scenes on some cases that came out in this last session, and we ended up on the losing end of the stick for the affirmative action cases that were ultimately decided rightfully. But yet, even the 23 map that they just drew does exactly what historically legislatures are supposed to do. And I'm proud of their efforts, I'm proud of litigation, and y'all, this fight's not over. And I made it very clear that we still have the right to fully litigate it. I do think the case from South Carolina is going to sort of elucidate some of the issues. I don't know if you saw this. Georgia just had last week a federal judge do the same thing that our three judges did here in Alabama. And although I recognize that y'all didn't really get impacted here, it does impact our state. And y'all, losing one Republican seat in Congress matters right now, right? We see that. And us standing strong on these principles, because to the extent that our legislature had truly backed down and done something that we think is inconsistent with the law, then not only are we setting the precedent for what took place in Alabama involving Senate case, Alabama Senate districts that are going to be litigated, other cases in Alabama, including the Jefferson County Commission, which finally has their fiscal house in order because they have conservative leadership there, could have impacted there, but it's going to impact what's happening in Louisiana, in Texas, in Georgia, and in Florida. Those matter. And when we have a razor-thin margin right now, any seat that we lose is important. And so, to some extent, I believe Alabama is the tip of the spear. And y'all, just because we lose a case at one time doesn't mean that we can't ultimately win. And we had that shown to us very, very visibly relating to the overturning of Roe versus Wade. How many different cases finally made its way through the system, but yet we continue to get beat back. But we finally got a case there, postured right over the years, and we were able to flip it. So while we may have lost the initial battle, it doesn't mean that we've lost the war. And again, I really am thankful for a legislature that showed the courage to do the right thing, and I think acted absolutely consistent with the law, gave me the ability to make an argument that I think should be the winning argument. And look, we want to be able to get back there and to be able to change the minds of some justices. Y'all don't know what we can do in our prayer life, but one thing needs to be to pray for Justice Thomas's health, because he needs to be there as long as possible. Because he wrote a dissent in the case where we lost on redistricting that was absolutely spot on. And that theory that he talked about, his recognition of where we are in the state, was spot on. And we need to be able to continue to be able to support what's going on there. Y'all, and then finally, I think it is still incumbent upon us that when we're attacked by the groups on the left, that we continue to stand up. One of the big fights for me right now, and we don't really have time to get into it, but I really don't want to encourage you to look into it, is around the concept of ESG. Are y'all familiar with this at all? Shakes their heads, yes, no, some. Look at it. Because it's where the left, when they can't get what they want through the legislative process, they try to get it a very different way. And that's through corporate America. And I've appreciated a little bit of leadership that we've seen coming from the state of Florida, and particularly Governor DeSantis, around this idea. But basically, it's a small group of folks on Wall Street who think that they are enlightened, and that they're going to use the power of the control of money to cause change in our country. And it really is around climate change, number one. And it's also around this concept of gender ideology that we talked about earlier. And so we've spent a little bit of time pushing back on that front. I had a chance to be able to go to Congress, and y'all had a one-on-one, me and AOC. It was fun. It was fun. She didn't even really ask me any questions. I was really disappointed. Jonathan, I was ready to be that cross-examination witness, and she just didn't give me that chance. But it was within House oversight to expose this myth that is what ESG is purports to be. But the other thing about it is it's fighting for the retirement savings of 52 million Americans. Because the Biden administration wants to be able to tell investment advisors, you can consider all these non-pecuniary factors in investing the money of people you don't know that have worked hard their whole lives to be able to save for their retirement. You can invest it around these issues that have nothing to do with the return on investment. And y'all, that's completely wrong. Because if you worked your whole life to be able to have retirement, you need to make sure we're maximizing your return. And so you hear this idea of woke capitalism. Well, that's really what this is about. And so it's a little bit kind of an issue on the edges. I don't think that we've dealt with it very well in Alabama yet. And we have to, but I've also made sure that we position ourselves to push back. It's against some of our financial institutions. Have you heard about Chase Bank? It was a conservative Christian group that had a bank account, nonprofit, with Chase Bank, just a checking account. And suddenly they get a letter from Chase saying, we don't want to bank you anymore. Unless you tell us who gives you your money, what political candidates you are connected to, what issues you're involved with, that's not their right. I don't want to have the ability to get that information anyway, but if they're going to debank people because of issues of faith, if they're going to debank you because you happen to believe a supporter of the Second Amendment, and y'all don't believe that our firearms industry is not somebody that has been targeted by the folks around ESG, then we can't sit silent. And so this is something that we're going to continue to push and continue to talk about kind of moving forward. All right. Everybody full? Had a good breakfast. Thanks for letting me come to North Alabama. Y'all know Gunnersville was home for a long time. My late wife lived in Asbury, so she was almost in DeKalb County. So this has always been an area. People that are in this room have been longtime friends from when I had a real job and putting bad guys in jail. Y'all, I will tell you, 7 years as your Attorney General, remarkably blessed. I was turned 59 this week, and my wife and I were having dinner, and I really just told her I don't know anybody that's luckier than me. I get a chance to do a job that I love with remarkable people like Thomas that I get a chance to work with. In a state that I care desperately about, and y'all give me the freedom and the luxury to do good things, I think. And that may mean I get criticized by the Washington Post, but you know, bring it on. Sometimes you define yourself more by your enemies than your friends, and so if I continue to make enemies like that, then I think that you're going to want me to continue to do the same thing that we're doing over the next several years. So y'all, thank you very much, and appreciate you having me this morning.